Hello, and welcome to episode number 95 of The Big Web Show, Everything Web That Matters. I'm your host, Jeffrey Zeldman, and my guest today is the amazing, incredible Jake Archibald. Today's episode of The Big Web Show is sponsored by lynda.com. You can learn it at lynda.com, an online learning company with more than 98,000 video tutorials that teach software, creative, and business skills. Membership starts at $25 per month and provides unlimited 24/7 access to top-quality video courses taught by expert instructors with real-world experience. Learn anytime, anywhere, and at your own pace, from bite-sized tutorials to comprehensive courses in web design, development, business, photography, audio and video, 3D and animation. Sharpen your skills in Bootstrap, jQuery, CSS, JavaScript, HTML, user experience, content strategy, and more. Stay current with modern best practices. With new courses added every week, the lynda.com library helps you keep pace with the fast-changing technical and software skills required by today's working professionals. Learn on the go with optimized mobile site or the free lynda.com iPhone and iPad app for members. Try lynda.com free for 7 days by visiting lynda.com/bigwebshow. That's free for 7 days by visiting lynda.com, lynda.com/bigwebshow. Jake Archibald is a developer advocate at Google, working with the Chrome team to develop and promote web standards and developer tools. Prior to Google, Jake worked on lanyard.com's mobile app or mobile site, using modern web standards and good old hackery to work smoothly on ancient devices while adding enhancements for newer devices such as offline support via app cache, I suppose. And Jake also spent 4 years working at the... He looks like he's 12 years old, but he seems to have been working for quite a while. Jake also spent 4 years working at the BBC writing low-level JavaScript that catered to their strict accessibility and browser support requirements. He authored and maintained the corporation's standards and guidelines on JavaScript and sat on their working groups for accessibility, markup, and download performance. That's the BBC, not Sid's Golf Shop. It's the BBC, a very serious and profound organization. I don't know if there are only a few organizations. There are only maybe one or two other news organizations of that caliber in the world. And I don't know if they take web standards. I don't know if web standards and accessibility are as much of a priority for any other news organization. Any insights there?
Well, I'd say that the stuff the BBC is doing now with responsive design is amazing. I mean, they still have this great track record with, you know, progressive enhancement with accessibility, but they're so modern with the responsive design stuff. Their responsive news team and the Guardian as well, doing similar things. Like, they're building up their new mobile sites to eventually sort of replace the desktop ones. I think those guys are doing incredible work.
Do you know the people? I mean, England is a big country, but web design always seems like it's kind of a small world and like everybody knows each other. Do you know the people who are working on that stuff? Have you been asked to consult on any of that stuff?
Well, most of the stuff's happening in London, right? I mean, a lot of the BBC are actually moving up to Manchester. That was kind of a big move to be cheaper. So that's up in the north, kind of towards where I'm originally from. But there, quite a few of their teams are still based in London, and the Guardian's still based in London as well.
But you're not.
I am. I live towards Brighton, but I'm in the Google office in London at the moment. So yeah, we see a lot of the guys around. I should apologize. I was trying to find a good meeting room to do this recording, and I found myself in possibly the smallest one in the building. So if it sounds like I'm sitting in a toilet cubicle, I can promise you I'm not. I mean, we've got video going, so Jeffrey, you can confirm that.
I can confirm. I was just about to do that. Let me hasten to do that. We're actually, I can only see you from the chest up, so completely confirm, but it looks, if there's a toilet in there, it's a very strange place for one, because it looks, from what I can see, it looks like a conference room. It's a very live room.
There is definitely a glass window there, and that's not how we do our toilets here.
It looks like stained glass, but looks like ones and zeros in stained glass.
Yeah, it's little blocks. It does have a sort of binary feel to it. I guess it's to keep us in a programming mindset while we're having conference calls.
When you started at the BBC, or were you working on the web before that?
No, pretty much straight out of uni. Well, I did an internship at Reuters. I was in their HR department, sort of just working on internal stuff, like, you know, intranets for some of their external facing recruitment stuff as well. But pretty much as soon as I left university, I went hunting for something, working with external sites, doing some more in-depth stuff, like, you know, with JavaScript and things like that. And there was an opening at the BBC, and off I went. And
what? If you don't mind my asking, you took a degree at university. What was it in?
Yeah, I did a degree in a place called Middlesbrough, which is a bit like a town, but worse. It's kind of buried up in the northeast of England. It's quite a horrible place, but they've got a pretty good university. And I did a course in multimedia, which was kind of, I mean, so I started in 2002. So having a course which was kind of very much focused on computer graphics and the web was, you know, there was very few universities offering that. Despite that, the course was very much focused on Flash, which I guess is a shame. Really popular back then, right? You know, everything, right. We want things flying around the page, and you couldn't do that in plain HTML back then very well. But there was one course in the first year which was making a website, and you weren't allowed to use Dreamweaver or whatever. And it was I'd heard of it done before, but it was really the first time that I'd been forced to go out of that comfort zone. And we also had a module.
You started it with Dreamweaver.
Yeah, before university, I was using whatever there was going. Really, right. I think I started on using the Netscape one, the one that shipped with Netscape Navigator 4, and then used FrontPage. I hadn't really considered writing the code. When I was younger, I kind of, because I had an Amiga for years and years before, and I didn't get a PC until like 1996. It was a Windows 95 machine, but I was really into sort of a program called Deluxe Paint. It was an art package. I thought of myself as a designer, I guess, and I think it's when once I kind of went to university and started meeting actual designers, I thought, I'm not actually very good at this. I should probably go back to coding. I think I was better suited for that. So, but
let me just geek out on the Amiga for a minute. My brother and his girlfriend had one years ago. It made the Mac look like an IBM PC clone. I mean, no offense to Apple. I love Apple, but Amiga was just ridiculously creative.
It was so good for graphics and so good for music. I mean,
they're musicians, so they were like sampling and looping and building tracks. They were doing multi-track recording and creating, synthesizing sounds.
Yeah, using actual samples as well. When I first got the PC or first used a PC, I was kind of looking for what's their equivalent to module files, and I found MIDI files. I was like, wow, well, everything on the PC is better, so this is going to be amazing. And I double clicked it and said, what is this?
Yeah,
what have they done?
Yeah. I remember my first PC and Windows 3.1 and using Black Leather Jacket, I think it was called, to make hideous background colors for everything, and reading a book, a very thick book, so I could understand how to write config sys files so I could add some memory to Microsoft Word so I could use fonts with it. Yeah.
Those
were the days. Those were
straight in at Windows 95 when it was starting to get a little bit better.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you started web in 2002, and so you went from Flash is awesome and I'm a designer very quickly to becoming a pretty serious front end developer, a serious developer all around.
I stayed with Flash I kind of had a respect for Flash for a long time. Like, I think the first time I spoke at an event apart, actually, my slides were, I didn't tell many people because I was giving this talk about web standards and stuff, but my slides were done in Flash because at the time I wanted animations, I wanted full control over what happened, and Flash was a really good way of doing that. Yeah. And it could do it faster than the browser could. But that changed it like 3 years ago, I guess. And I kind of did a prototype of the same thing, but in the browser, I was like, oh, I've just hit double the frame rate. Bye-bye, Flash.
Did you, and that really leads to the whole question I think we want to talk about today, which is, you know, proprietary native versus web standards. But did you feel like you had to bury, was it hard to put Flash to rest? I mean, did it hurt?
No, I wouldn't say so. It wasn't, part of the course I had at university, they showed you how to use Flash in a way that was using it in a very programmatic way. So, you know, Flash is essentially a document object model. So right. Transitioning from that into onto the web was not too bad. It kind of lacked some of the good animation libraries like GreenSock, but GreenSock's on the web now. And soon we're going to have the, you know, native web animation framework, which is going to do a lot of that, which is just looks absolutely brilliant.
How do you keep up with all the new stuff, all the shiny new stuff?
Oh, I've been on holiday for a week. I got back at the weekend, which is, you know, I've been in Spain for a week with a few friends from university. And that's why you can tell I've got this lovely bronzed tan that I get very easily. But I was
really,
not
from what I could see.
It's just the lighting in here is very, okay. Very bad. But the great site that I love is webplatformdaily.org. The guy who runs that, I don't know. I assume it's all he does, and he's just constantly plugged into the internet like the Matrix. And every day he comes up with this list of links. And I use RSS still. I love RSS. And I, you know, Google and dropping Google Reader, that was a terrible, terrible shame.
Yeah. What do you use now?
I use Feedly. I didn't
say that again.
Feedly.
Feedly, right.
So, yeah, Feedly. I didn't, one of the podcast readers, managers I use, they worked off Google Reader and they switched to Feedly. So that was pretty much the decision made for me. So, it's possible that there are better readers out there, but it's working fine for me. And it's got apps on the phone as well. But yeah, webplatformdaily.org, just, you know, loads of links every day, and for me to just go over a week's worth of that, and you know, I was adding tabs to the browser until you couldn't see the icon anymore, so you could barely click on them. But that was a great way to catch up from a missed week.
How technical would you say most of the stuff is? In other words, could someone, a designer who's a bit of a front end developer, get much out of reading automatic JSON parsing via xhr.responseType equal JSON?
Yeah, I guess it is quite slanted towards specifications, news that, you know, changes into specifications and the very technical side. There used to be a guy called Vasilis.
That's not a bad thing. Just
No.
Right, it's just a specific. What
it's
about,
not something I point a designer at, I guess. Right. So there is this good discussion of like responsive stuff occasionally, but there used to be a guy called Vasilis who did a site called Daily Nerd, and he did the balance of design and tech much better. It's a shame he's not doing it anymore, I think.
Yeah, the guy from the Netherlands.
That's him. Yeah.
He hasn't posted since what? Well, he's actually July 18th he posted something.
Well, he was doing it as a hobby, and it just ate his life. I think Smashing Mag started paying for him to, but it was still just a thing on the side. And I think it just took over too much. And he's just posting every now and then these days. It's still good to see the posts coming though.
Yeah. So you recently wrote a rant, rather a long rant called Progressive Enhancement is Still Important, which was linked by a bunch of people. And you actually, also referenced Nicholas Zakas is enough with the JavaScript already.
Mm.
Walk us through why, who do you think is attacking progressive enhancement?
I don't think anyone is particularly, I don't know if they're attacking it. I think because it felt like a one argument, right? I mean, I remember, you know, we had this thing, progressive enhancement's the way forward for these reasons, and everyone went, oh yes it is,
right?
And we all walked
in
away.
The 2000s,
right? Exactly. But I think what happened is we got a load of new developers on the scene, and I think people who were maybe as they were learning the web, or maybe also learning sort of native stuff at the same time.
Yeah.
So they got so used to this whole idea of things being created with sort of scripting and coding languages rather than, and markup was this kind of alien thing. So I think that's how this has crept in, as people have started sort of, you know, building up these large JavaScript frameworks to sort of, you know, make things sort of work out of the box instantly. And that's just sort of crept in.
Are they not learning about markup, or because the Java framework does it for them?
I think they probably see it as being less advanced than using a JavaScript framework. And if you want to be serious, use a JavaScript framework. You know, get it trained to the code. Like, if you know code, use the code. What's markup for? You know.
So it's like 10 years ago when people were using .NET or other backend technologies to do amazing things, but had utter contempt for HTML. Thought it was just rubbish. Thought it was just baby stuff, and it didn't matter. And that's why you'd have a really sophisticated back end, usually bad UX, bad HTML, and a really powerful code, right? So there'd be this wonderful, brilliant stuff happening on the back end, but they would write everything with like break tags and table layouts and Lord knows what else, and because it didn't matter, right? Because it was just like, you know, if the front end stuff was baby stuff to them.
And I found where all those guys are. They're making websites for banks, because I'm trying to buy a house at the moment, so I'm dealing a lot with websites and banks. And I, you know, just the amazing lack of I mean, and it's not really their fault. It's clear that someone who is doing a very like a large work amount of Java backend has suddenly been. Had the whole job of front end and UX dumped on them, you know.
Well, the people who do that, I have friends and some people at Arc90, which is a really good studio in New York, and they do tons of bank stuff, and they have all that Java back, but they also have respect for the front end and respect for UX. It's the, you know, the whole package. I would hope that most agencies are doing the whole package, but you're right. I mostly experience it, you know. Airlines, any big kind of computing intensive, where lots of stuff has to happen, data has to be crunched, credit cards have to be read in, that kind of thing. It seems like they focus on that task, and they have no interest in making it usable or comprehensible to an ordinary person.
Where
there are people who basically learned programming back in the days when everyone will be trained in how to use something, right? Mm. Remember that? I mean, with the web, we expect web software to just work and we can figure it out. And now we expect apps to work that way and software to work that way generally.
Yeah. When it comes to people's opinion on the web and how it should work, there's an article that kind of got me really riled recently. I haven't had a big public rant about it apart from Twitter, but you know, that's what Twitter's for. There's an article called Why Mobile Web Apps Are Slow.
Yep. I linked to it a week ago.
Ah, yes. And it's massive.
It's massive. Yes.
It's huge, and it's well researched, and it's got lots of good data. It's got lots of good references. My problem with the article is it doesn't prove the title, and I'm kind of surprised that no one's really sort of pulled them up on this, because
you get exhausted. I think that's the problem.
There are some
you forget what it's supposed to be about.
There are some people who rely on that tactic on the WG mailing list. It's just throw words at it until people get tired and just give in.
But so yes, please take us through this. So what is Drew Crawford? He's saying mobile web apps will always be slower because of all the JavaScript and because of all the what?
Well,
server calls.
Well, this is it, actually. Most of the article is it just deals with JavaScript. And we get these sort of diagrams saying, well, you know, if you do this in JavaScript, it takes this long. And if you do this in native code, it takes this much less. And the difference is drastic. You know, you kind of, oh my God, that's massive. What the article doesn't prove is that JavaScript is the reason that web apps are slow. And I really don't believe they are. I mean, we know you can make websites, web apps that don't use JavaScript at all. And it feels like it's saying, well, you know, the mobile web is on this sort of old mini car, and, you know, native apps are in this Ferrari. And I say, well, that's not really the problem, because it's not the car that's the problem. But, you know, the roads, you know, terrible. The road needs taken care of. It doesn't matter how fast your car is, the road is unsuitable. And if you use some like remote debugging tools and look at something like Facebook's web offering or Twitter's web offering, things are getting blocked on painting, on things like network, things like all mobile devices at the moment. When you tap the screen, the thing has to wait 300 milliseconds to see if you're doing a double tap.
Right.
It's just crazy, you know, that we kind of thought, oh yeah.
Does Android do that too? I know iPhone does that.
So all the browsers do it. And if you opt for a fixed viewport, like so you can't do a pinch zoom, then there's no reason to wait for a double tap. So Chrome Android will optimize for that. Firefox and Android will also optimize for that. But we've actually just landed a patch into Chrome. So, because I think pinch zooming is useful, right? It's a nice accessibility feature. Yeah. So now if you have like width equals device width, like that meta tag, double tap becomes useless unless you pinch zoom in, because then double tap is for zooming back out. So we're kind of finding, we're trying to reduce the need for double tap down to a very small edge case, so we can, you know, you press the screen and that checkbox changes.
Right.
Just, you know, what we want really.
So a lot of it is the perception, right? It's not that things are, a lot of slowness is based on the accumulation of little details like that and the perception overall that things are a bit sluggish.
Yeah, well, all you need to do is go to a website that has a checkbox, and on your mobile phone, press that checkbox, and it feels slow. And you think, "Oh, my phone's really bad at doing the web," and it's just deliberately waiting. And for me, this is what's making the mobile web slow. This and we need to solve painting, and then we're in a position where we can start making web apps that do similar things to Photoshop, like image filtering. And that's when we start thinking, oh, we're running into our bottleneck might become JavaScript at that point. It's not at the moment. And then I think the Mozilla guys have got a great idea with ASM.js, which is a way of taking C code, compiling it to a kind of subset of JavaScript, but running it using a different interpreter, which can be more towards the speed of C. And so I really don't think this JavaScript thing's a problem for web apps.
Do you feel like, to some extent, you're being tarnished? You and all responsible developers are being tarnished by this sort of careless work of people who are less informed, who don't think about the performance so much.
This is a problem with any new medium for apps, right? It's especially if it's open and like say Android is, that you're at the very start, people are going to go and right, well, I want an app as soon as possible. I want to build an app and get it on there. So you get a lot of stuff that's not very good. And this, you know, Apple get around this by having some degree of checking, although, you know, not all apps on the App Store, on the Apple App Store are great. You know, certainly there's a lot of apps on the Android App Store that aren't great. And so I think there's always that bit at the start where people just go and try and use all of the features in a thing, and it's not very good, and it takes some time for the quality to start coming up to the top. A good example is Photoshop, the lens flare, right? You know, you give someone Photoshop, like, oh, I can make lens flares happen. And then you've got lens flares coming out of people's eyes and, you know, any area of brightness. And, you know, but then people start going, oh, actually, we shouldn't be doing that. That's overkill. And I think that's what we had. You know, we had that with Flash. We have that with JavaScript.
Right.
The quality, you know, takes time to bubble through.
So, but Even with that being said, there's an aesthetic problem with every new technology where everybody wants to do all kinds of things that aren't necessary. I remember seeing the first Microsoft Surface when it was on a big table, and it was amazing. Like 10, 12 years ago, it was amazing, but there was a lot of excessive dragging, and it was almost like it was designed to show off its capabilities instead of being designed to be used, if you see what I'm saying. So, well, that's the aesthetic issue that you're talking about. But even leaving that aside, isn't there often a technical issue of you can do the glitzy thing in a way that still respects performance, or you can do it in a sloppy way? I mean, aren't you focused on both those areas in the work that you do?
Oh, definitely. And I think in terms of rendering performance, when I see developers who aren't really caring about rendering performance in the browser, I can't really hold it against them, because it's only been recently that you can actually really do anything about it. And in a talk I gave about this, we were working in Internet Explorer 6, say, and we were happy for these just static two-dimensional pages to kind of just be, just perform well enough to be usable. Mm-hmm. And this was on the same machines that we were playing Quake 3 on or whatever, you know, these huge 3D worlds with like running at 30 frames per second, 60 frames per second. And we, you know, we know that's not good enough anymore. And it's only been the past couple of years that browsers are actually able to hit 60 frames a second. And so it is really a new thing for developers to care about.
Talk a little bit more about frame rates, because I think that's something not everyone knows about, right? Mm. Video frame rates, web, TV, film, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so the screen on your laptop or on your desktop screen probably runs at 60 hertz, which means that 60 times a second, it's going to update what's on the screen. And that means that's the maximum frame rate you can deliver something at. And this is a problem we had with some older JavaScript animation frameworks, is that they were just trying to create as many frames as they could, because they, you know, most machines would max out at somewhere below 60. But then, you know, we hit a problem where some of these sites or some machines are trying to generate 100 frames a second, but, you know, only 60 of them are ever going to happen. You're just going to max out the CPU, and some other process is going to come along and actually want to use some of the processor for a bit. So now we can hit 60 frames per second, but it's only been the past couple of years that we've had a method called request animation frame that will give you the opportunity to set up to change something visually on the page, and it will synchronize it to these refreshes on the screen. So it will, you give it a function and say, I want you to, you know, I'm going to do some graphic work. Could you, let me know when that's best? And you give it this function, and the browser will do is it'll wait until it's just finished the previous draw. And then it'll call your function. And then you've got this 16 milliseconds to get your frame together. You've got the maximum amount of time possible to have everything updated, to let it draw, and then it appears on the user's screen.
I don't know what to say.
So, this is something that's been happening in the film industry for ages as well. You know, they want to synchronize with their content to the screen. Like TVs in the US, when they came out, they were running at 60 frames, 60 hertz, because that's the power supply frequency in the US. Right. The rest of the world mostly tended to use 50. And so that was...
Yeah, that's film is 24.
Film is 24. So when they wanted to show a film on TV, or if you want to watch a film on your laptop, for instance, what it has to do at 60 hertz is it will... it will display the first frame for 3 refreshes, and it will display the second frame for 2 refreshes, and then the next one for 3. And that's the only way you can get 24 frames per second to divide into 60.
That's why there's stutter on like a pan. I'll be watching, you know, HD video or a Blu-ray, and everything else is amazing. But when it comes to the panning shot, there are definitely visual artifacts. And that's why, right? Because there's 24 doesn't go evenly or into 60.
Right. And that's and once you notice it, you can't unnotice it. And I think anyone listening should go and, like, if they watch stuff on their laptop, like modern TV shows all run at 24 frames per second as well. But yeah, watch out for the pans across the scenery. You'll see that jerking around, the janking. And that's it. That's watching TV spoiled for you on your laptop. Sorry about that.
But so everything that you do in JavaScript now, you can actually you can control how many frames per second?
Not at the moment. I mean, this is something we keep talking about, because at the moment we give you this function, and it will give you the most amount of time it can for you to get your frame ready for the next refresh. So if there is a screen running at 75 hertz, which some projectors, some screens do, some laptops when they're on battery power go down to 50 hertz to save power, and so it works all of that out for you. It's not just sort of guessing at when it should prepare the next frame. So, but you are just going to be running at the refresh rate of the screen. If you overshoot the budget, if you take say 18 milliseconds to get your frame together, then it will throttle you back to 30 frames per second. But it's that consistency of frame rate which is more important than a varying frame rate.
Since you can't really know it, I mean, you would never really want to specify a frame rate anyway, would you? Because Wouldn't that be like specifying a pixel width and then finding out that there's a new device with it, you know, with more pixels per, I mean, isn't exactly. it the same risk?
And this is the problem we've got with jQuery, for instance. They run their frame timer assuming 60 frames per second. And even then, it's using one a JavaScript timer, which isn't very accurate. So it tends to kind of run at about 58 frames per second. And if you do animation in jQuery, you'll see this something move across the screen, and it will sort of stutter when it misses that frame every half a second or so. There is a plugin you can get for jQuery. I will find out the URL for it. If you search for, I'm just going to search for jQuery request animation frame, and that will normally bring it up. Yes, and it's the first result. It's on GitHub. It's by a guy whose username is Gnarf, G-N-A-R-F.
That's lovely.
Yeah, I'll give you this URL to put in the show notes.
I've got it. Yeah,
and it's a tiny little bit of code. And it makes jQuery animations use request animation frame if it's there, makes everything so much smoother. It does produce a little bit of backwards incompatibility, so it's not something you should just drop in your page. And this is why jQuery just haven't included it by default. If you're using request animation frame, if you move to another tab, the animation will pause. Request animation frame won't fire until you come back. And this proved to, I mean, this is great because it saves battery, it saves CPU. But it did create a backwards incompatibility with the old system, which would still run in the background, especially if you have like an animation that sort of you've triggered to start every 5 seconds. You could end up with a situation where you're in another tab and loads of these animations have queued up and you go in back into the other tab and they all happen at once and everything breaks. But if you're starting a new project, definitely use this plugin.
Okay. How do you explain what you do to the designers and marketing people and reporters and so on that you work with? Or right now you're at Google Chrome, so that's probably not much of a problem. But back when you were at BBC, how do you work with other people, basically? You have such a specialized area of knowledge.
Well, when I was at the BBC and at Lanyard, I did work at an agency in between as well, it was very much, I guess it was very waterfall, especially at the agency. You know, I got a PhD of a design and went and coded that up. And my attitude to work there was the designer's a king. You know, whatever the designer says goes. My job is that PhD I've got is to do that at least as good as it looks there, within reason. You know, but I wouldn't go to a designer and say that is impossible. I would go and say something like, you know, this particular feature is going to take me 5 days. This thing, which to me looks equivalent, is going to take me 10 minutes. You know, how much do you want that other thing?
Right.
I loved working with designers for that reason, because I saw every new design as a challenge, and I would even sort of, you know, go to them saying, hey, do you know what? I can, not only can I build this, I can make it move around like this. And sometimes they go, Jake, that's horrible, don't ever do that. Yeah, but sometimes they go, oh yeah, that's quite cool, or make it this little bit more subtle and we can work with this. I don't have any time for developers who say no. It should always be some sort of compromise.
What should we expect from Chrome? What's top secret cool stuff are you working on right now?
Well, we're kind of, because we split with we forked WebKit, right? So we're right. Sort of on our own, although we're still, you know, taking bits of code from them and they're still taking bits of code from us. So the code base is still similar enough at the moment.
Do you have separate elevators from them? Do you guys go up separate
as well?
Elevators?
I don't think we don't even work in the same building. You know, we never have. We didn't kick them out. It wasn't like the, you know, people with guns came and took the WebKit people away. But no, it's still very friendly. People, you know, still talking. We're still talking on each other's sort of ticketing systems to a certain degree. I think Apple employees have it a bit more difficult in terms of sort of licensing or what they're allowed to look at. But I mean, don't quote me on that. Well, you know, I'm being recorded on that. But I don't. I think that's the case. But what kind of stuff are we working on? So we're I'm involved with a lot of the JavaScript stuff at the moment. We're trying to fix the offline problem. This is a big deal for me at the moment, that and this comes from the work I did with Lanyard. We made m.lanyard.com work offline. We made it progressive enhancement where you could work across browsers, and it was a horrible pain. And from the back of that, so, you know, I
Application cache is a D-bag.
Yes. Slightly controversial article, but people did listen, and we are working on something better, and we've been keeping in touch with the Mozilla guys with it. We're hoping to go public with it, but it's already public because it's on GitHub. But we're hoping to sort of make some noise about it this week, in fact, or later this week.
Does native have an advantage over web there in terms of offline?
Oh, certainly. That's not to say every app uses it. I mean, there is this idea that, yeah, native is really good at offline, and it has the ability to be, because it's got a lot of low-level control over when things come from the server and when they don't. And that's what we're hoping to give the web. But yeah, a lot of apps just fail horribly as soon as you're offline. But we want to bring that kind of power to the web and hope people will actually use it. It does require a kind of change in mindset, though. And it caught me out when I was building Lanyard. If you want to make something work offline, it has to be offline first. And that was the thing that took me a while to get my head around. And I think that's the thing other people are having trouble
with. Say that again so I can memorize it.
Please. You need to build it offline first, as in, it's a piece of progressive enhancement, right? But the network connection is now an enhancement that you can't rely on from the start. Just like JavaScript, just like all of these things. So when what the application cache did is if it had a cached copy of your site, it would use it even if you were offline. And that caught me out. It caught a lot of people out. But it's doing the right thing. To say only do this when you're offline is a really difficult, because you would have to then define what offline is and what is offline. If I could have no connection on my phone, fair enough. I could be connected to Wi-Fi, but that Wi-Fi router have no connection to the internet. Mm. The site I'm trying to get to could have some DNS problem or a proxy problem just to that site.
Right.
And I'm as good as offline then in terms of that site. So this is the idea, is that, yeah, and good native apps, they kind of follow this model. If you go to, if you like open the Twitter app, you're shown content, even if you don't have a connection. It's the last content it had, and then it will go to the server and look for new stuff.
New York Times app, same thing. It's disconcerting if you haven't opened it for a couple of weeks. You're like, wait, because the news is old.
Yes, yes.
Like, really? Nothing's changed that much? Oh, and then it downloads, yeah.
So that's the model that you would have to go to for this as well. Well, actually, we're going to give you the choice. That would be the performance solution. But we are also going to say, you can, if you want, you have full control. You can say, I want to try getting this from the network. And when that fails, or if that fails, that's when we're going to go to this other thing we have, this offline alternative.
What about caching stuff on the user's machine? Like, they visit your site once. the way we store a cookie on a user's machine, just like, or like storing fonts, if you use a Google font, that it's on the user's machine because they visited another site that used it and they don't have to download it again. Things like that.
Yeah. I mean, we've got a cache, an HTTP cache already. But if you want it to be reliable and atomic, as in the normal HTTP cache, you've got your CSS file, your JavaScript file, some imagery. In the HTTP cache, one of those images might disappear because it's making room for something for another site.
Right.
And, you've lost one file and now your site's potentially unusable, or especially if you use like a CSS file. So what we're building upon is this thing that application cache had, which is an atomic cache. With the new system called navigation control, you'll be able to create multiple of these cache groups. Like you'll say, maybe if you're building a game, you'll have one group for level one, one group for the core assets. If you were making Wikipedia work offline, you could have like the core stuff as one cache group, and then you could create a new one for each article. And then you would say, I don't consider this cache group to be complete and usable until all of these files have been fetched. And, I want them all to be updated together. So you'll never have this situation where, the JavaScript file disappears, but the rest stays.
Where can people read more about this now?
Well, I mean, we're going to be talking, releasing something on the WhatWG soon. But if you want to get down with have a look at some of the specification that we're working on, it's on GitHub. It's github.com/slightlyoff. slash navigation controller. It's slightly off his Alex Russell's account, who's been spearheading this whole thing. He's been doing wonderful work on it. But at the moment, what we have is we've got a couple of like explainer documents, and we have the specification written in TypeScript. Well, the mistake we made with application cache is it's a very high-level API, but we can only make high-level APIs when we understand the problem, when we know what people actually want to do with it. So when we're looking at like script loading, like we have years of seeing how people load scripts. We can do a high-level API for that. With offline, we don't have the evidence. And the result of that is, you know, something is made for a set of assumed use cases and it doesn't work.
Right.
This is something much more low-level. To do the equivalent of app cache, it requires more typing, but you are telling it what to do. Whereas in app cache, you add a line and it assumes a load of stuff and probably the wrong stuff.
That's absolutely brilliant. Who are you working on this with?
So it's Alex Russell, I say, is heading it up. We've got quite a few, the Chrome guys, some of the guys who do Google Docs. I mean, they've got a very extreme set of requirements for offline because they want to make Google Docs work offline. But In that GitHub repo, I've kind of got a set of ideas for applications that we're going to make sure that that not only is it possible, but it's sensible. Things like a game, things like Wikipedia, things like single page apps. How can we make this work offline? We're also talking with the Mozilla guys. Anna van Kesteren's been helping a lot with it. We've been talking to Jonas Sicking as well. It's we're hoping it's going to be something that that everyone gets into, but it's still early days, and it's part of this whole thing about taking it to the standards group. Is we've got this; it's not ready for eating yet. What do you think? You know, where is it going wrong? What do we need to change?
If people want to get involved, is it open to them because it's on GitHub, or you kind of want to keep a?
Yes. Oh no, it's completely open. We want people to take part in this. There's an issues list for, and we've already had some external people sort of adding issues, and we've been talking to them about stuff. The current contributors have added a lot of issues as well. There'll be stuff on the mailing list as well. One thing that we're hoping to release at the end of this week is a custom build of Chrome. There'll definitely be a Mac build, hopefully a Linux build as well, that will have a kind of rough prototype of some of this. So if people want to start actually playing with the actual moving parts, we'll be getting towards that, but it will be, it's very early days.
Are you working with both Macs and PCs all the time now just to do what you're doing?
We've got a machine that a group of us in DevRel we use for testing, and that's the Windows machine because it's, I mean, we've all got VMs, and VMs are great. We use those a lot, but I mean, a lot of what we do is performance work, so a VM is not really suitable for that. I work on a Mac, and there is part of me that gets slightly worried about this, like because it seems to me like most web developers are Mac based now. I haven't seen any numbers, but finger in the air, and it bugs me slightly that we spend so much time making sites on a machine that is higher end and different rendering than most of the users will see it. And that kind of, makes me feel uneasy. But you will take my Mac off my cold dead hands.
Right. I'm right there with you. I have exactly the same feelings, right? Mm-hmm. I believe in progressive enhancement and design for everyone, build for everyone. But then I'm, fine tuning on my Mac. Wow, it looks so great now. Yeah. I don't like the way this font renders on my Mac, so I'll use a different font. Yeah.
Yes. Yes, just because you're hitting 60 frames per second on your shiny 2012 Mac or 2013 Mac doesn't mean it's going to be 60 frames per second for regular users.
We should add that we have this, lest anyone think we're just like rich guys bragging about our cool toys. This is work-related. We have the shiny new because we have to, right?
Yeah, I've never actually bought a Mac. I've always had them given to me by richer corporations. So
there you go. Well, any plans to go out on your own at some point?
I'm afraid of freelancing. I know lots of people who do it really successfully. I'm such a 9 till 6er, I guess. I like to,
a 9 till 6er.
No, a 9 o'clock in the morning till 6 in the evening.
Nine till sixer.
Yeah, I like to come into the office, and then when I leave the office, I like to be thinking about something else. And this was one of the reasons that sort of startup life didn't really suit me, is I was kind of, it kind of was part of my life too much.
Yeah.
I mean, even if I go home and do web stuff, I kind of want it to be different web stuff, you know?
Right. Some fun thing for you, some creative thing for you.
Indeed.
We're running out of time. People can find you on jakearchibald.com. Mm. They can find you on the Twitters at Jaffa the Cake, yes. JaffaTheCake. There is a story there, surely.
Yeah. You want to hear it? No, yeah, we got time.
Jaffa the Cake. Let's hear the story.
It was when I was at school, and we were doing comics in English lessons. This is when we were really young. And a friend of mine was drawing a Star Wars comic. And this guy is a good friend of mine, but he's also colorblind. And he was about to color in Jabba the Hutt. And he held up this orange pencil crayon to me and said, "Jake, is that brown?" And I sort of looked at him and just in a moment of cruelty went, "Yes." And so he colored in Jabba the Hutt in orange. And then the teacher came over. And in the UK, we've got these chocolates called Jaffa Cakes, which are sort of orange biscuits. And the teacher said, "Well, what have you done there, Alan?" And Alan went, "Oh, it's Jabba the Hutt." And the teacher went, "Oh, it looks more like Jaffa the Cake to me." I was like, "Oh, I'll have that. That's my internet name now."
So you felt guilty?
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah. I kind of wear it to remind me
shame.
Of the virtues of cruelty.
Yeah, okay. That's pretty awesome. You've also written for List Apart. You're all over GitHub. Is github.com/JakeArchibald.
Mm-hmm.
And you're on Google Plus as easy to find user number 1162. I'm not going to do it.
No, don't do it.
Just Google Jake Archibald Google Plus and they'll find you.
Mm.
So thanks very much. Hope to have you on again. Mm. Hope to see you soon.
Yes.
Have a great rest of your day, and thanks for making the time.
Oh, thanks very much for having me. Cheers.
Cheers. And thanks once again to our sponsor, lynda.com.